Tonight it's my pleasure to welcome to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Kelly Child, author of The Lehigh Key. It's right over there. So Kelly studied physics at San Jose State and works in the laser and optics industry. He plays drums in many Bay Area bands, enjoys fly fishing, is married and has four children, having developed his theological studies within the Mormon cosmology, and also being a member of the ancient mystical order of the Rose Crucis, he has recently released Lehigh Key, which is here to talk about tonight. Please join me in welcoming Kelly Child.
Thanks. Thank you very much. It's really exciting to be here tonight. This is super cool. I'm going to leave my wallet with my wife to throw my back out of alignment. So I'm excited to be here for a lot of reasons. This bookstore is actually a secret little place where I sneak off to and get all kinds of books I shouldn't be reading, which I love. And I'll explain that comment in a moment. One of the pinnacle moments in my decision to write a book came from talking with Jim, actually. I was in here and I don't know what we were talking about. I think it was just that idea of writing a book, and you mentioned that you'd written, you know, a book, and you showed it to me and told me how he used CreateSpace, and I thought, wow, okay. And all of a sudden it was like there was this avenue that I could follow to do this. So that really actually kicked off what would become the next year and a half of going through the book writing process. So it is neat to come back here to kind of, you know, back to where this sort of in some ways originated. So I guess I want to share a little bit, firstly, about myself. There's another theme that comes up, and this wasn't intentional. I'm a fly fisherman, so I've spent many, many years in rivers, standing in rivers, watching the very smallest rivulets start up in the very tops of the river drainage basins and flow into each other and combine and join together into one great sea. And so the analogy of rivers is something that's very beautiful and very close to my heart. Also, my studies in physics are based around light, being in the laser industry. And I love analogies that have to do with light and concepts around electricity and magnetism. And those are terms that also were popular during the Age of Enlightenment. That word light is right in the middle of Age of Enlightenment. So that theme comes up in my book. I have a few sections where I talk about that. But from my background, kind of what got me to a point in life where I wanted to write a book about spiritual things, if I look back, I've had a few spiritual experiences in life. And I started out life I was born in 1970, so I was raised in the 70s, as a 70s kid. And I lived in Minnesota till I was about 9. I was a free-range child, so I could go roam around the neighborhood, and I particularly liked looking for bugs, butterflies, and little flying things. And Minnesota was a great place to do that in the small town that I lived in. My parents have always been very very hands-off in terms of allowing me to experience life. They let me fall, they let me get up. I got interested in music when I was 11, got into playing drums, and Keith Moon was my first inspiration. I even kicked over a drum set when I was 18 on stage just to try it. I didn't like it really, it was kind of just too much. But I eventually got into progressive music. I got into physics my senior year in high school. I really didn't like any of my other classes, and I liked Pink Floyd, I liked The Who, I liked the fact that they used lasers in their shows, and I got into to physics, basically. And so a couple things that you know, if I look back at some spiritual experiences I had, I go back to this one that is just my earliest memory of something really interesting. My family went to a local Christian church. It was a non-denominational community church. Does anybody here have Christian backgrounds? Raised, a lot of us do. Yeah. Okay. And I don't recall much of the experience except for one time. I remember they were having a get-together, and we were supposed to bring a rock. And it was supposed to be something that we would be giving to Jesus. That's how I remember the understanding of it. And I got really excited because one time while I was swinging on the swing set, I found a little black rock in the ground. I knew if I go out, I thought of it as magic rock. What it really was, now I know, is it was old charcoals from burnt up logs that were under the ground. But I thought it was really neat stuff. So I went and I got one of those. And as we were leaving, my parents went and grabbed a little rock from our little pile of rocks, you know, in our kind of out in the front yard where we have, you know, landscaping rocks, like little things. And I was a little bit worried because they were just grabbing one and they weren't thinking about it very much. I thought, that's, you know, you really got it. This is for Jesus, so you really got to do this. So, but we went there that night, and I remember people in this line putting down their rocks, and I put mine up there, and I got a little worried because it was smaller, but it looked different. It was this little black rock. Anyway, this ties in with a dream that I had. That was, you know, a dream that I remember to this day. And in that dream, I was in that church, and I went through this sort of hole in the wall, and it was dark, and everything was covered with snow, and there was pine trees, and they were covered with snow, and being in Minnesota, that makes sense why these sort of dream symbols would come up. And I remember going down this sled, and as I was going down through this forest, I heard lightning, and I got scared. And all of a sudden, it hit this end, and it hit this cliff thing, and I went off, and as soon as I went off the edge, I guess I'd seen Mary Poppins, because I suddenly had an umbrella, so I opened it, you know, and I started floating. While I was floating, I was over this river on the other side, and the dream ends real shortly, but one of the last things I remember seeing was a tree, and in that tree there was lights. And I, you know, all I know is it was the most peculiar dreams, and it stuck with me for that long because it was just so weird. And as a child, you know, age 7 or 8, I, you know, really had this feeling of, you know, this is really poignant. So, I would say another experience I had later in life, I always looked back on that. It's just kind of, it was strange. But I had this experience when I was 16, and I was, basically it was a weekend. I took off on my motor scooter. I had a Vespa. I rode into the foothills, and I parked that thing, and I went for this long walk. I remember wearing Converse tennis shoes and a Who concert shirt, a pair of Levi's 501s, started walking up in the mountains. This is in the South Bay, Montebello Mountain. And I remember hiking. I just went far, and I had no sense or wisdom about what I was doing. And I ended up quite nearly to the top of this mountain, and I started to, you know, I was kind of worried because I realized I couldn't turn back. And I hit this juncture where I could go left or right. And I, being a little bit nervous, I decided I'd go ahead and try praying. And I felt, go to the left. So I went to the left, went to the top of the mountain. Now, I don't know exactly what to make of it, but I can just tell you what happened, and you can judge for yourself. But I got up there, and I realized I'm never going to get down this mountain before dark. And I started walking down the road, because the Montebello Mountain hits up with this road, and a truck went by, and it happened to be these two high school girls, a little bit older than myself, driving up to the top of the mountain, and I had just seen them at a wedding a couple weeks before. And I don't hitchhike. I felt comfortable. I could, you know, I could probably thumb a ride down. I kind of had a guess as to what they were doing up there at the top of the mountain that afternoon. Well, that's where a lot of teenagers would go for various things. But So they gave me a ride down, and I look back at that and I think, I don't know that I can, you know, explicitly say that that was an answer to a prayer, but it sure felt like it. These are kind of events that really put me in contact with something else out there. At age 12, I had been baptized into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints after I met some Mormon missionaries that came to our house. I had a Scottish friend who asked me, "Do I believe in God?" earlier, and I really didn't know. He said, "You know, if you do, do you believe that he's really an old guy with gray hair, or is it just some powers that are out there?" Oh, those are good questions. I really don't know. He played Dungeons and Dragons, so he had a lot more ideas about what it could be. I really didn't get very involved in the church until I was about 18, and I decided, you know, that there was something there that, to me, was something that I needed in my life. I was pretty chaotic as a teenager. Again, Keith Moon was my hero. So the structure of that church was something that appealed to me. Kind of the straight and narrow was something that I needed in my life. Maybe not for everybody. Certainly not for everybody. But for me, it was important. And at age 19, I followed what a lot of the guys and young women in that church do, and I served a mission. You've probably seen Mormon missionaries riding around on bikes, white shirt, tie, knocking on doors. I did that. I did it in Florida. I went out, it was 1990. I spoke, I taught to English-speaking people for 3 months, and then Spanish-speaking people for the next 18 months. I think that's up, right? 21 months, next 21 months, in Miami and that part of the world. And it was an amazing experience to be able to find people that were interested in this message that we were bringing, which was a very basic and simple message. And it's just the message that God has a plan for each of us, you know, individually, and that we can come in contact with them. Now, the Mormon Church, has anybody here had any encounters with the Mormon Church or familiarity, or other than the news and all the recent drama and all that? Yourself?
I had a strange one, but I can tell you later.
Okay. Yeah, well, hey, you know, strange is totally valid. But as far as, like, did you attend the church or have friends?
I went to the, I was traveling out west here from Wisconsin, where I was raised, and I went to the big, it's in Salt Lake City, some huge...
The temple there?
Well, I'm not sure it's the temple. It was a sort of a convention hall where there was, I guess, there were speakers and they would explain Mormonism, and we saw a movie of life after death, and everyone had the same Job's daughter's robes on. I was a Joby. My dad was a Masonic. Anyway, so they all dressed up in white, and they were all Caucasian and blonde. And I raised my hand and I asked what was happening with people of color, and I don't recall the answer, but I later found out that they weren't even allowed in the interior of the church.
What year was that?
1969.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, there was the church in Utah particularly has a lot of New England heritage. It's very heavy in New England, and then also there was a huge influx of converts to the church early on from England and Norway, Finland. So you see a lot of that, mm-hmm. that Northern European heritage. So yeah, okay. So there you go. That's kind of it. So the church is basically a Christian church. Now I'm gonna give you a little background, because this part of the story leads to what comes next. Lots of dogma. In other words, they have a very, very tight philosophical system, to the point that once you've been in the church for 20 years, if you've had any responsibilities in teaching or any guy that's been active in that church for 20 years is going to have it pretty dialed in to the point where you can, you know, your views of everything are pretty much the same. Now, there was what I would call a pretty big stir up in the last 15 years, because during the 80s and 90s, we didn't have, early 90s, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have a lot of information moving back and forth. In the early 2000s, some history that had been left behind, because it's not as endearing to the Mormon dream, started to kind of come out. More information about Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and their involvement in polygamy, which by today's standards is exceptionally different. The methodologies by which Joseph Smith, the founder of the church in the early 1800s, came up with what he felt were revelations, and his followers believe are his revelations, were something that we would term as folk magic. But that certainly was not the view of how that stuff happened. So when we all found this out in the last 15 years, it's funny, you get lots of different responses in the church. You have some people that said, oh my gosh, and were bailing. Some people, like myself, said, okay, I need to just take a step back and look at some of this new information that's just really coming out. What it really is that there's a strong correlation between the early church and the Age of Enlightenment mysticism, the folk magic, the spiritualism, the occult philosophy, all were solid foundations for the thinking that the early folks in the church based pretty much everything they believed on. Now, they had their own thoughts, and a lot of intelligence came out of that group early on. So that leads to what happened for me. Now, I guess a little bit more about the church. It was in 1820 is when Joseph Smith had what he called his first vision. Now, Joseph Smith, does anybody heard about him? Mostly horrible things, or I don't know. He's a real mixed bag. I mean, he gets a lot of attention from modern historians, because there's still so much mystery around his life, his contributions, what he did. But at age 14, he claimed that he saw a vision of God the Father and Jesus Christ in a grove of trees in upstate New York, not too far from his home. There's other cases in history where people have had similar visions. Paul, the troubadours, people have seen angelic visions, sorts of things. This would fall into that category. And this really kicked off for him what became his spiritual path, and then the church followed. He was a very interesting character, very New England blood. The Smith family, his grandfather had fought in the Revolutionary War. His family were, they attended a Methodist church. There was a little division within their family. The area at the time was going through what was called the, it was kind of a Christian revival in that time frame. The New England area also had a very acceptable culture of folk magic, Solomonic magic, different types of beliefs, phrenology, the idea that you could read some of the shapes on somebody's face and learn something about them. So this is kind of the environment in which things were going on. People were finding old artifacts, and so there was a certain amount of treasure digging going on, and there was sort of mythologies and some mysticism around how one could go about finding treasure. Well, that's the kind of stuff that Joseph Smith came from. So in 1830, after he had generated a book known as the Book of Mormon, he formed the church. From there, it's amazing how fast it grew. It you know, grew to be, I think, 10,000 members by 1840. Lots of persecution, you may recall, you've heard about this. They became one of the largest groups in Illinois in the 1840s. So they became a kind of a threat in terms of political power. Interestingly, they also became all initiated into Masonry. This is one of the great things that nobody in the 1980s, when I was growing up, knew. Nobody knew it. I came from Cupertino, California. Mormons in the 1980s were much more affiliated with Donnie Marie Osmond and, you know, the kind of vision that had been built in the last, you know, 40 years than with Masonry. They also developed their own temple ceremony, which is probably largely derived from Masonry, also probably from Rosicrucianism. They also understood the ceremony at a deep enough level. They understood the symbols well enough that they were able to devise their own symbols that were also incorporated with it. They also, one of their things that was a little bit more progressive, really, is whereas the Masons did not have the women involved in their ceremony, they did have other auxiliary groups. The Mormons actually, in their temple, have a very, very central theme of male and female duality, equality, roles, divinity, and you know, it's very interesting, and it's based on the story of Adam and Eve. So I won't go too much into that. That's the Mormon temple secret mystery school type stuff. But this is exactly the point where I ran out of answers. I started going to my local leadership and saying, hey, you guys, what about, we have this thing, it's called an Abraham facsimile that Joseph Smith found, came his way and he purchased. And what it is it's an Egyptian hypocephalus. It's this very strange, you know, hieroglyphics. It's round, and he wrote some story around it and attributed it to Abraham. Now, modern scholars attribute it to somebody named Shishonk, and that it was written about the time of Christ. So that's a pretty big deviation from the idea that it came from Abraham. So there were some really big discrepancies in some Mormon, you know, understanding. So from that, when I went and I talked to my local branch president, who's like a local bishop, they said you shouldn't be asking this kind of question, which is so classic. It's like a movie, you know, like, really? Come on, this is like a dialogue from a, you know, just a bad made for TV movie. I'm like, is there anybody else? Can we, you know? And they said, well, you know, yeah, go talk to the stake president. So they escalated, and I said, okay, perfect. So I went and I talked with this. He understood his history very well and was able to kind of say, you know, you can look into all these things if you want. You may not have to. But he understood the history of Gnosticism, Hellenic, you know, times, you know, all of the different forms of Christianity that came out of the Christian era. And so I decided, yeah, I'm going to go look at this stuff. I told my bishop, I'm going to take 3.5 years. I don't know, actually I said three. It took 3.5, though. 3 years, and I'm going to go and study this stuff. And he said, because I was a teacher at the time in the church. I was teaching young men, young women, Sunday school classes. And I didn't feel like I could go on until I had an understanding of all these different discrepancies and what they, you know, what are my new thoughts on this. So that's what kicked it off for me. And it became one of the most wonderful experiences I've ever had. I mean, it is just a milestone in my life. I guess, what are some of the highlights? I was single at the time. I decided to go ahead and scrap my whole understanding of theology and start just, what do I really, really believe? What's my real core belief? I'm like, well, what do I really know? I mean, I don't know. I do math. I do physics. I know the things that I see with my objective eyes. And I started with, well, I was really distraught. I mean, this is, I don't know that I can convey how absolutely at a loss I was. What a void there was in all these places where my mind had relied on this theology. It just wasn't there anymore. And so I thought, well, I just went real extreme. I thought, well, in the beginning there was nothing. I'm like, okay, Big Bang, nothing, dot, energy. Okay, that's fair. Nothing, zero. What's it all like? Zero, one. Okay, zero, one. I'm like, so I resorted to numbers. I'm like, I feel like I can rely on my pragmatic mind. My you know, math is something I feel confident. This is something where I don't feel like I can be duped in. I felt like I'd been duped. So I really went down relying on my scientific side and just sort of developing my own beliefs in this sort of way. And what I eventually found was that I still had spiritual experiences. I had abandoned my belief that there's necessarily a God, or that maybe I had been anthropomorphizing things that go on around me. I don't know. I know that I started to have this experience where I'd wake up, you know, I'd be thinking about something, and I have an epiphany in the morning. And the oddest thing was, I noticed this several times, but somewhere throughout the course of my day, somebody would say something that was very, very closely related, that almost gave me information about the topic that I was curious about. And I was blown away, like, really, like, almost freaked out. And I kept sort of pursuing developing my own understanding. At a certain point in time, I decided, you know, I can go back, I can look at my theology, and what is my new understanding? What did I used to believe? What do I believe now? Or what do I think? And what I ended up coming to was, I ended up looking into really some of the history of religion. I started looking at where did our traditions come from. So I started looking, what is Masonry? Well, has anybody ever studied, like, the it's about a 2-paragraph history. You can boil it down to, if you really, you have a little bit.
I've looked at Masonry. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you're aware that typically it's thought to have started in about 1717.
Yeah, I used to know the names, but I read it all, but, you know.
Okay, right, yeah. Yeah, that's
chain it all.
That's kind of where that's where I'm at.
Right, what's his name with W, right?
What's that?
I can't remember.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I know it was associated, you know, there's the Knights of Templar and the Masonry, and it goes
right
all the way back into the Crusades. And
that's right.
Some people say it all goes all the way back, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, to the Crusades and before.
Yeah, right. But 900 AD is, I think, when the Europeans went down to Jerusalem.
Knights Templar and all that.
Right. They found some stuff, and the story goes that they found some stuff in the old temple that
right
was there.
Yeah, I read all that.
Yeah, and
review for me, though, because that's been a while.
Okay, yeah, I mean, basically, and these are the rivers that I'm talking about.
Holy Grail, search of
the Grail. It's all in there. It all interconnects, and it's very exciting, because it's very cool, because there is, I would say, I don't know how to say it, but there is a magic about it as you study it. There is a power to it. I found that as you study something, that you will find that little pieces of info sort of come together. They tend to come together a little bit quicker there than with other things, which is real neat. Some of the things that I found that flowed into where Mormonism came from, I thought, well, Joseph Smith was into Solomonic magic. The temple is said to have derived from Masonry, so we'll take that.
What exactly is the Solomonic myth?
Oh, yeah, okay. So that is a whole thing that I'm not that into. But it has to do with the use of talismans and the idea of interacting with angels.
Oh, okay.
And there's a whole system. It ties in, I believe, with Kabbalah as well.
Oh, okay.
don't totally quote me on that, but if you went in that direction, you'd probably
back
be...
Back in the 3rd century, some of the writings that came out about 300 or 400 AD.
Oh, yeah, I don't know too much about that.
Go.
Okay, no, that's cool. So those are the kind of the veins. The Mormon Church has a huge focus on genealogy. That's always something I've been interested in and studied. So what ends up coming out in my book, I look at geometric symbolism. It's part of what temples have traditionally had partly incorporated with how their ceremonies are designed. Number symbolism. Again, I feel real confident and like comfortable with numbers, with math, physics, and these sorts of things. Number symbolism shows up throughout the Old Testament, the New Testament, and I also found out it shows up in Mormonism. Okay, well, that's kind of interesting. Etymology, word meanings, is another thing that I became very interested in. I found a book by a guy named Harold Bailey. It's called The Lost Language of Symbolism. Now, at the same time all this was going on, that movie The Da Vinci Code had come out, which kind of pointed, it kind of said, hey, Holy Grail, over here, check this out, you know. Dan Brown did a great job of engaging people in, well, there's not this, maybe. Maybe it's not the whole Catholic thing, or maybe it's not this entirely, but maybe check out this area, too. The concept that there were royal families in Europe that kept esoteric information, and meanwhile you have this great Catholic Church and the great churches of Europe being, you know, completely infused in the political system and vice versa, but meanwhile kind of off the grid, underground, you have these traditions of other thinking, philosophical thinking, other concepts, spiritual thinking, mystical thinking, ideas all around that. So with Masonry, for example, there was a close tie early on between the history of between the European royalty, the French, some of those early families, the Merovingian dynasty got a lot of notoriety from Dan Brown's movie, because they were able to fund some of these crusades to go down to Jerusalem. And then, you know, people would go down to Jerusalem. So they set up these knights that were dedicated to helping people go to the temple in Jerusalem or down to Jerusalem and have their spiritual crusade and experience and protect them on the way.
Because financially protect them. So they took their money and then they gave it to them. Kind of like a pledge,
yeah, it was
money,
like,
and then they go to Jerusalem, and that's how they got their money. It was like a bank.
Yeah, it was a bank. That's right. Developed one of the first banking systems. Yeah, you can put your money here. Here's your da 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 da. Here's your secret, you know, code, and here's a chip off of a piece of pottery. And when you get to the other end, if the pottery fits, it's your piece, and you get your money back. So. These kind of ideas. So yeah, they a lot of intellect developed within that group. So the way they operated, they had an initiation. There were other initiatic rites back earlier in the Roman era that they took their initiation concepts from. It resulted in a lot of loyalty, some core beliefs, some commitments to chastity, and other things. And as the story goes, it developed also in correlation with families, Austrian families, English families, French families throughout Europe, that in these certain families they would keep like a temple ceremony. They started to piece things together and work things together. This is all completely out of the sight of the Catholic Church. Bailey's book, Lost Language of Symbolism, shows how they used watermarks to trade symbols. It was watermarks on paper. So when you write a letter to somebody, send it off to them, it's got this symbol and a watermark. Now, the notion is that if you look at that symbol and you're spiritually in tune, you know, two people here or there will look at a symbol and be able to derive the same meaning, because symbols have generally a universal meaning to them. This is pretty interesting to me. So For me, it resulted, I ended up going to Europe. Again, I was single, so I had a little extra money on my hands that I don't have so much of now. It's just the way it is. But so I went back and I visited some of the chapels, the cathedrals back there. The Gothic cathedrals in particular were notorious for having esoteric symbols that the temple knights, which eventually were also engaged in bringing intellect over into building cathedrals, and they were able to kind of work that stuff into the stonework without the Catholic Church knowing. It was amazing, and it's really phenomenal. One of the biggest questions that drove this became something bigger, which was for us, this basically European culture. How do we come to where we are? How do we get out of these what we call dark ages, which is what we call them? I wasn't there, but I believe that's probably true. Getting away from plagues and living with just some crazy thoughts. Getting to where we are now, to this way that we think, that with scientific method, a lot of contemporary thinking that's more ordered and productive. So this is a central movement that was going on, is this philosophical, and I'd heard somebody refer to it as the underground stream. And it became a very complex system. It evolved into Masonry. You had lots of what was called really the European Lodge system. And the European Lodge system is essentially various groups throughout Europe that took the same, what they're called, temple principles that came from those early origins, and they started to compile this information and create these different groups. You can maybe even see some documentaries on the History Channel. Things like we hear about the knocks and secret handshakes and things to get into to talk with the secret people. Well, that was going on in Europe for real. The thing was, it was in the 1600s, 1700s, it was dangerous to talk about something that was not orthodox. You could get in real trouble. 1500s, you could get killed. 1600s, you could get in real trouble. And so the idea is, these temple groups would set up a place somewhere. And you had to really be tapped in to be able to find out where that was going to be and catch wind of that one way or the other. In fact, I'm going to read something, if I can find it. The early incarnation of the Rosicrucian order, the first announcement that they even existed was a poster went up throughout Paris. And in that poster, it said, let's see if I can find this here. I didn't mark this. So this might take just a moment. Here it is. I'll just go ahead and read from this. It says, in the summer of 1623, something happened one day. Like waking up in the morning to find dews had settled out in the night, something distilled out of obscurity. All over the walls of Paris appeared a poster. We, the deputies of the Higher College of the Rose Croix, do make our stay visibly and invisibly in the city by the grace of the Most High, to whom turn the hearts of the just. We demonstrate and instruct, without books and distinctions, the ability to speak all manners of tongues of the countries where we choose to be, in order to draw our fellow creatures from the error of death. He who takes it upon himself to see us, merely out of curiosity, will never make contact with us. But if his inclination seriously impels him to register in our fellowship, we, who are judges of intentions, will cause him to see the truth of our promises, to the extent that we shall not make known the place of our meeting in this city, since the thoughts attached to the real desire of the seeker will lead us to him and him to us. They had this amazing... Yeah.
See, I've just kind of been hanging out waiting to see, you know... I've read about a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
To me, the central theme of that whole thing is that they were taking the power away from the Pope, because they were saying, like the Rosicrucians, they were saying that there was a mystical experience that they could have directly with the divine via the divine light. So the light was a huge part of the symbolism in their mystical experiences.
Right.
And that was the connection with their divine instead of via the Pope.
That's right.
And so it was all about mysticism, and it was all about that connection with the divine that produced immortality.
That's right.
So they were all into immortality, eternal light, eternal life through the divine light in their mystical experiences. That's right. In a nutshell, where everything, that whole trip was coming out.
That's exactly right.
Which really goes back to, you know, Jesus and the ancient Jews, and especially the 3rd century back in there, they were really into that.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yep. And what you find is it seemed heretical, but at the same time, it's absolutely Christian and really the purest, in my opinion. It really is. And one of the things I liked about them, now I'm a member of the Rosicrucian Order myself now. One of the things that they do is you don't have to go and meet with anybody. And that's kind of what they were saying there, is you can actually do this between yourself and God. We'll help you, but we're going to, you know, and everybody tends to keep at a distance and avoid the social things that happen. Because isn't that the irony? Did anybody see Life of Brian by Monty Python? But right. The first thing he does is, as soon as everybody believes that he saw God, they start following him around. And he drops a shoe, and everybody holds up his shoe and says, "We found a shoe." And the problem is, as soon as you get a church going, you get sociology. So, yeah, that was something that they really, the individual relationship with God. Yep. And that's something that I think, for myself, was very appealing about adding the Rosicrucian experience to my life. So that's kind of one of the veins is that history is one of the things that I studied. The other one is geometric symbolism, and I picked up a book in this bookstore, a really good book on sacred geometry. And the idea with sacred geometry is that geometry itself is one of the most kind of simple forms of symbolism, and it makes sense. So a dot can represent unity. A line can represent duality because it goes in two directions, has two points. A triangle, 3, represents manifestation usually in the European way of looking at symbolism. A square will typically represent, you guys ever heard like this kind of thing, like the earth and it's 4 quarters, or people used to think that the earth was square. They didn't really think the earth was square. Philosophers might say that it was square, but people didn't believe it was square. That has to do with physical creation, having been created physically. So the physical plane, the 4 elements, earth, fire, water, and air. I think that's 4. And then it goes on, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and each number has a geometry associated with it, and also has all kinds of meaning associated with it. There's little tricks that folks do with compasses and squares, which we know are symbols of masonry, to draw, for instance, the Vesica Pisces. Are you guys familiar with the Vesica Pisces? It's 2 circles drawn like this, where the end point of the radius becomes the center for the 2nd circle. So it creates basically the Jesus fish vertically, and it becomes also a symbol that the cross section becomes a symbol. We use them in Venn diagrams nowadays, but it's the atoning, or the area that makes this thing and that thing at one. So it becomes a symbol of harmony, unity, but also atonement of Jesus Christ. So that's where you start to see it show up in cathedrals. So you have sacred geometry and Christianity all working together. The geometry coming, of course, from the mystic temple builders and their esoteric knowledge that they kept to themselves, and then the Christianity coming from the Bible and the clerics and the church. Actually, and I've followed through and tried that with a square and compass, and you go through each of the different shapes, and it actually creates what's called a tree of life. Book, I don't know if it's still available. It was like the pink thin book, so pretty good book. Etymology, amazing. So this is just absolutely amazing resource. If you can find a good book on etymology, you can look at what modern words and our semantics that we've given to them are not what they were ever intended to be. But the amazing thing about the English language, and some folks believe the Druids had a part in this. They were big into poetry. The Druids are the secret guys, you know, from the Celtic world. Poetry. So English words have this amazing effect of when they rhyme. I mean, you've probably run into this, Jim. Sometimes when you find like a two words that rhyme, you also find that the words work together to create a third meaning, or you derive.
Or there's a whole, they're very related.
You've seen this.
Yeah, they're incredibly related when you start looking at all the rhymes.
Like yes.
This word is that way because it's associated in meaning somehow with the other word, and that therefore
that's it.
Works, and you can tell marvelous stories with it.
Yeah.
Example?
Yeah. What's that?
Have any examples?
I've got an example. But go ahead. I'll share this one with you. Yeah.
There's a poet I really like by the name of Mary Shelley Salter. She a contemporary poet, and she was interviewed about rhyme, and she said rhymes tell you they're like little lessons that are actually embodied in the language,
right.
and it's like a chime, yeah, where you're being told to pay attention to this relationship.
To the story. Yeah.
And she, the example she gave, which was night and bright, you know, like,
yeah,
and at night, bright, flight, you know, like, and there, she said, there's a the reason those rhymes are used endlessly and repeated over and over again, you can find them in countless poems, you know, like, and sight goes in there, you know, like, is because there's a resonance of meaning and even a kind of a commentary on each concept, you know, like, so that, like, night and bright illuminate each other through that resonance. And then she talked about how when you go to different cultures, there'll be different cultures have different lessons embodied in their rhymes. And that's part of what...
Wow, yeah.
And that's part of how you extract the meaning. It's
a source of wisdom.
There's a... cultures have a certain tone or a certain understanding. It's cultural, and part of that is through this resonance,
yeah,
that words have with each other. Am I
that's perfect. No, that's exactly. And it's not easy to put it. It's not easy to describe. When you see it, it's like. But you know, our ancestors and Europeans. Look, we're a pretty European crowd here. Their philosophy also seemed to have a sense of humor in it too. A subtle sense of humor. When you come across it, you can't really avoid it. But So my sections I break out, I talk about rivers of light. One of the rivers is a river called etymology. And I have a quote by Robert Frost, says, "Poetry is when emotion has found its thought, and thought has found words." So, So I wanted to, I started the book, here's the other thing is, when I wrote this in a, what I would call a Janus-based way. I tried to write it so that it's accessible to a broad range of people. My old Mormon buddies will read this and get something out of it, but I've got such a friendship in the pagan community at this point, so many friends I've met, that I'm like, I want this to be accessible to them. I want my mother to be able to read this. So the first 70 pages are written so that anybody's mother can read this, hopefully. And then, but so I started, and then I want, it, you know, I didn't want it to be super pragmatic, so I told some stories, and I put a poem in the front, and I call it a spring poem. And I actually wrote this, it was on a cold, damp, wintry afternoon in the wooded, misty hills of Montebello Mountain about 6 years ago that I lamented my woes to divinity in the heavens above and in the earth below. I was in the company of groves of old oaks, and some of my sentiment went to their gnarled stumps and twisted branches. Perhaps they'd relate. They too were covered in part with green moss. I just want to note that throughout this book, I put down as many symbols as I can. I wrote the book largely for myself. I mean, to be honest, it's chock full of symbols that when I read it, it reminds me of concept. Green, there is, and I mentioned that things are covered in green moss. Green is a symbol for kind of an obscured language. So you're not necessarily going to pick up on it. It's called green language. And you could probably look it up and find something on the internet. So it's throughout this book. The paths along the hillsides were of firmly packed mud, and the air was uniformly still. As I walked the winding path that traversed the northern face of the hill, I emerged from the woodland groves facing eastward, towards the esteemed Valley of Silicon. Between two of the more prominent hills in the east, a full moon was rising in the purple early evening sky. The fallen tree branches, rocks, and trailside plants were alive together, while a moist, chill late winter's air kept those akin to comfort at home and not passing through these woods, leaving an immensity of space for the faintest of sounds to be heard. Even a drop of dew falling from a leaf to a puddle below might be noticed. And as soon as I could get a pen in hand, I wrote the poem that the scene inspired, a spring poem. The earth is my favorite book. Her loyal pages tell no lies. Truth springs from her soil. No man can put his spin on her, no reporter, no politician, for she only dances on her axis with her lover, her dance partner, the sun. His arms turn her gracefully in the royal courtyard, taking her by the hand to turn her in time, as upon a swirl in a mighty river of virtue flowing from his shoulder. And with swords of truth at the hilt, sentinels of stone stand guard, placed there by heavenly parents, who are the eternal authors of the universe. And though the sun must be set, the full moon rises in the east to turn the page, and my soul is at rest. She reads to me. Spring is my favorite season at this time of the year. The winter is past. The full moon rose in her coronation between two great mountains to watch over the night, her reflection cast upon the lake. She took yesterday's chapter and the truth that she gave with her. It was more than I could bear. Though I desired to stay awake and stand guard, I fell through the mists into slumber, and my soul received rest. And in the morning of spring, outside my window, a bird sings the song of the season, a scent of a rose, though but a wisp in the breeze is my guide. And virtue's knowledge, as the dews of heaven, also rest on their petals. Where did the mists of night go? Where is their power? And in a fourth, there is a third, the number of my favorite song. The east morn sun beams cut through in two, and in the light there is no wrong. From the lake his sword is returned, the master to his waiting bone. The coronation of her king returned, take his rightful throne. Spring is returned, the bees and creatures are voicing. The king and queen provide the feast and wine, a great day for rejoicing. But where is the page of yesterday's chapter, who read and wrote of the lover's dance, placed under guard by some stone sentinel in the east? The meridians of velocity, probability, and chance. But never mind, that book is lost. The page is taken back, the spring is here. The sun has returned. I can't think of one thing that I lack. The earth, moon, sun, and stars are now my favorite pages. A new book in the sun's light. The rivers, mountains, breezes, and sun are always sure and right. I read in awe. And I really liked that. Looks like my time is just about up here. All of these rivers that I studied, sacred geometry, number symbolism, etymology, the history of thought in Europe, and all the things that led up to the religion that I belong to the thinking that around us, the country that we belong to, the deeply embedded symbolism in the letters that we see on signs that have nothing to do with the deep spiritual meanings that are in them. We can start to see the world around us is very alive. This flow is also it's also modeled in several cultures as being sort of the lifeblood or what flows through a tree. And in Hebrew mysticism, it's Kabbalah. In ancient Egypt, the very thing that I believed was the downfall of the Mormon Church's canon of scripture and these sorts of things, this hypocephalus turns out that it itself is a tree of life symbol and an amazing model of the flow of light. The Norse also had a tree of life symbol. It shows up everywhere. It shows up at three different points in the Book of Mormon, and the most prominent and well-known one throughout the church is a story of Lehi. And I don't know. Do I have time, Jim? Okay. In the Book of Mormon, the story starts out with a man that's living 600 years before Christ. Now, whether we want to think of this as fact, allegory, or however, it doesn't matter to me. It's he's living in Jerusalem with his family, and it's getting rough. Babylon historically takes over Jerusalem not too far after that, in about 545. This is a little bit before the time Pythagoras would go and study in Egypt. 600 years BC, ironically, is also really the time that kicks off the era of the philosophers with Thales at 600 years BC, followed by Heraclitus and Democritus and these. What's that?
Thales? Thales?
Yeah, I don't know how you pronounce
Thales,
it.
Yeah. Thales, yeah.
And so that's kind of what's going on. And he, Lehi, relocates. He leaves Jerusalem. He says, we're getting out of here. We're taking our genealogy with us. His family consists of four young men and his wife. And they go to the Red Sea. It starts out, he has a vision of seeing a pillar of fire on a stone. And this is where he gets his revelation from. He has a vision of 12 stars, and some of these symbols that are sort of common symbols. You know, a pillar of fire on a stone is a Greek sort of idea. Ether, the light of Christ, it might be a kind of a Christian conception, especially particularly when you look at John chapter 1, verse 1, where the word of God is compared to light. So him and his family leave Jerusalem, and eventually they build a boat and go to what we believe was the Americas, the early Americas. And on that journey, he goes into a tent, and he's worried about his sons. He's got a couple sons that are wayward, and two that are kind of like the good kids. And he goes into sort of a dream state, and he sees himself in a world of darkness, sort of a putrefaction, kind of a real, what he describes as lone and dreary wilderness. He's brought there by a what sounds like a like sort of a man dressed in a white robe in his dream. And then he's left there. He waits. And then he starts to pray. And then he feels sort of a sense of mercy come over him, and he sees this tree. And this, it's a beautiful tree. There's a fountain of water that flows from it. And there's fruits in the tree that are white and precious and pure, above all whiteness, he describes it. And this fruit, he says he tastes it, and it tastes more desirable than all fruit. And then he sees his sons, and he sees a rod of iron that extends from the tree down a path. And he sees his sons holding onto the rod, his family, and it leads to the tree. He also sees a chasm filled with dirty water and filth, and on the other side of it, a great and spacious building with people in the building that are mocking those that are trying to hold to the iron rod and proceed to the tree of life. Some people on that path let go of the iron rod because people are mocking them, so they don't follow it, and they fall into the chasm of filthy water and are lost. Some stay focused. They stay steadfast and immovable and hold on to the iron rod until they proceed to this tree of life. They also partake of the fruit when they get there. A little later in the book, his son, his name is Nephi, desires to have the same vision. So he goes, and he goes up into a mountain. But he prays, and he has a similar vision of the iron rod, the tree of life, the fountain of water, a great and spacious field. But he also sees the Virgin, Mary, the mother of Christ. And this description of seeing her happens at about the time that he's also describing the tree, the white fruit on the tree. I've talked with some of my friends. We sort of believe that in some regards, the tree is a symbol also of a person. So as a person, in this case, it may be that the tree is symbolic of the Mother of God, Mary, or the feminine, or the divine feminine. So there's a third account of a tree of life vision later on, several generations later, by someone in the tradition named Alma, who describes an experiment of faith. One way that we can exercise our faith is by taking a principle and letting it sit in our hearts. It's like planting a seed, is how he describes it. And then you just create a little space for it, like in a garden, and give it some water and nourishment. And if it grows, you know, you see what it becomes. If it's a good seed, it produces good fruit. It's kind of, you know, you see this in the New Testament, a sort of symbolism. And if it dies or it doesn't produce anything, then it wasn't a good seed. And it's sort of a process for deciding, of all the many things that are out there, what is good, spiritual, real, or what works in your heart for you. And ultimately, in Alma's depiction, it also leads to a tree of life. So these symbols, in Lehi's dream in particular, the iron rod, he also describes a mist being around the tree that some people get lost in. If I take that dream, and then I look also at what happens in Chartres Cathedral, there's a labyrinth in Chartres Cathedral, and this labyrinth sort of reckons or heralds back to the story of Daedalus and Ariadne and Theseus. And Theseus entered a labyrinth on the Isle of Minos. Long story short, ends up battling a Minotaur. Ariadne leaves little gold threads throughout the labyrinth, which is how he finds his way out and goes off to marry Ariadne. There's different versions. He becomes a god, essentially. So the labyrinth is a symbol of of initiation into a higher level of spiritual living, where we begin to interact directly with God. The church helped get us there, maybe not, but once we go through this initiation, we interact directly with God. Lehi's experience was the same. There's certain symbols, the iron rod. His son sees that as a symbol of the word of God. So when you're holding to the iron rod, you're holding to the word of God. And now this book goes very deep, because all of this, as you continue to contemplate it and elaborate on it, you'll see that it is also the same set of symbols, the same set of symbols are equivalent to the meaning of the Hebrew Kabbalah. I don't know, has anybody here looked at the Hebrew Kabbalah Tree of Life? I thought you might. Okay. That's a very complex system that's very detailed, very thinky. So this does sync up with that, and I go into that. I put that at the end of the book, because by then hopefully all of my readers have properly fallen asleep before they get to that. But I like that.
There's all the levels of light.
That's right.
Yeah.
Four creative levels.
Yeah, all the levels of light. Yeah.
Yeah. So the four levels of creation find analogy with Elohim, or God the Father, in Christianity, Jesus Christ, the angels or archangels, and then Adam and Eve,
yeah,
in the Mormon theology, would be the fourth, the number 10.
And diffusion is going down, lesser shades of light, kind of a darkening almost, sort of.
Different energy levels, yeah. I don't know how you want to think about it, different states of being, archetypal levels, archetypal, physical creation. And so, yeah, and then from there you get into a lot of interesting things. There's a great author named Lon Milo Duquette who wrote a book called The Chicken Kabbalah, which I think I bought here. And it's a great book, because he's got a good sense of humor, real easy to read. It's not super heavy. It's like 175 pages instead of 500. But yeah, that's fairly elaborate, but it all ties together. One of the things also that I came across is the diameter. I hate going down this path, because you immediately sound like somebody that's talking about crop circles and stuff. But the diameter of the labyrinth is 42 feet. In fact, one of the things that keyed me off to go, and I actually went to Shark Cathedral and I walked to the labyrinth. An English author that comes from a family called the De Vere family, they're cousins to the Merovingian family, wrote a book that's really weird called The Dragon Legacy. In it, he talks about this labyrinth. Now, at the same time, the guy that was my mission president when I was a missionary for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, with my white shirt and tie, and, you know, straight-laced group of people, also noticed that Joseph Smith had done a strange thing in his own translation of the Bible, and he grouped the generations from Adam to Jesus Christ in three groups of 14, 3 times 14, which is 42. So it gets weirder than that, because once you go down this path, my mission president's book, which is based on sacred geometry, then says each of those generations, a generation on the average is 30 years, and if you multiply 14 times 30, you get 1260. Now, the cathedral here, the labyrinth, was dedicated in 1260 AD. So that was kind of like, well, that's kind of weird. I got the 3 times 14 factor. It's dedicated in 1260. Okay, so this is some really weird symbolism. And I'll just tell you, there is an entire canon of really weird symbolism that existed back in the New Testament, Old Testament, and early Christianity times, and it shows up here. 42 is also the number of laws in Egyptian, what are they called? The 42 laws of purity. And you'll find in a book that's called, The Hor Book of Breathings, H-O-R, Book of Breathings. talks about these 42 laws of purity, and it's said that these 42 laws constitute all of the cosmic laws. If we live in harmony with those, we become more like God. And this diameter is comparable also to this concept of straightness. A diameter would be comparable to, in Lehi's dream, the iron rod, the word of God. So here we have the word of God symbolically being equated with the Egyptian 42 laws of purity. And it goes on and on from there, up just over the against the west wall is a huge stained glass window of the tree of Jesse. And the tree of Jesse is also a lineage of Christ. It's depicted with six different segments of this white tree growing very, I don't know how you say it, I'm going to use Puritan terms, inappropriately out of his loins as he's laying on the couch. A huge phallic symbol. And in each of the boughs is one of his descendants. With Mary being in the sixth position, Christ being in the seventh position. Around Christ are these ten spheres. Now, Sephiroth, in the Hebrew Kabbalah, there's ten of them. So this tree that is coming out of the loins of Jesse has the same sort of connotation as the tree of life in the Lehi dream, as well as the rectitude is associated with priesthood and royalty and also kingship. So straight lines and square things tend to be male, and circular things and round things tend to be female. And that goes back to all kinds of symbolism, sexual symbolism. And, you know, this is where you get your dichotomy of symbols. The square being a more male symbol, the compass generating circles, a more female symbol. The labyrinth itself is round, much like a womb. It goes on and on. It's really beautiful. But and this book really is a walk through the Shark Cathedral, is what I start out with, but it's relying on that dream of Lehi that allowed me to piece together how these different tradition symbols all work together. And then once you kind of see how all the symbols at Shark Cathedral are working together, you realize that it's a real interesting connection between what we understand now in our various spiritual traditions and what existed anciently. Shark Cathedral as a whole, the symbols work together to create a complete message of what's going on around us, what we're doing here, some of the conditions by which we can become in contact with divinity, and so forth. So, it's been a wonderful experience sharing this stuff with you guys. It's definitely something. Again, I wrote it for myself. I had to get it out of my head. It was too much to carry around. It was amazing things that I was coming across. You can find a lot of it in this bookstore here. Do you have any questions?
Did you go to the Festival of Lights when you were in Charger?
No.
Oh, you know about it, right?
I've heard something about it. What?
That's amazing.
Did you go to it?
Yeah, I've walked the labyrinth.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
awesome.
I've been there, yeah.
There you go.
The light, if you ever go back again, the light show is outrageous.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I like nothing I've ever seen.
Is it on the cathedral itself?
Yeah, it's on the cathedral itself, and it's all over the town, and you just, at night, like, you walk, and there's lights on this path that you follow for miles.
Yeah.
And you just go to endless places where the businesses...
Is it... Because I know there's candles around the labyrinth here.
Yeah.
Would that be part of that? Like, that they put those candles out?
No, it's outside. The light show is outside.
Is outside?
And
okay.
And it's cast on the actual buildings, like the cathedral.
But it's amazing.
All over the community it's there.
That's neat. I love that little town. That's neat that you went
amazing.
Out there. Yeah, I spent a lot of time describing my experience there, I took photos of my own, but ironically I met this guy, and this is again one of those serendipities where it's like, whoa, it really blew my head away. A guy that we knew from church, it turned out that his stepfather is one of the number one labyrinth specialists in Europe. And so he gave me, I was able to buy some photos for the book for very inexpensive.
Well, that's the biggest labyrinth in the world.
Is it the biggest one?
Yeah.
As far as the stone cathedral labyrinths go?
I think that one's, like that's the creme de la creme of labyrinths.
It's
right
beautiful.
There.
You know, it's, if you guys get a chance, Grace Cathedral in San Francisco also has a replica of that labyrinth, and you can go there and walk it. And yeah, it's beautiful. We go there at Christmas time. So that's neat that you went there. Anything else? Well, thanks. I appreciate you guys coming out for us and coming back over to Rob.
Thank you so much. And thank you all for coming out tonight. As you know, we have a donation bowl over there. We share the contents with our speakers and retain the other part to help maintain this space. The Lehigh Key is sitting there on the table. A few other books that Jim has chosen to put out as well. Thank you so much. We look forward to seeing you again here at Many Rivers.
Thank you.